From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Kirstjen Nielsen is out as Secretary of Homeland Security, effective Wednesday. She announced her resignation yesterday after a White House meeting with the president, who was unhappy about the surge of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. One person who is responsible for pressuring the president to make personnel changes and to take a harder line on immigration is his aide and speechwriter, Stephen Miller. Gabby Orr is a White House reporter for Politico, and she's been writing about Nielsen's resignation and Miller's influence inside the administration. Gabby, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
So Nielsen went into this meeting with the president on Sunday not expecting to resign. What happened?
So I was told by a few people close to Nielsen that she went into this meeting to sort of set the agenda on immigration going forward. The president has been not so pleased with what's happening down at the southern border. He's been expressing frustrations to aides both inside the White House and at the various agencies that are overseeing border enforcement. And Nielsen just wanted to go in there and sort of work through what their plan is in the coming months, but also to address the situation that we saw unfold last week with the nominee to lead Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Ronald Vitiello. He was withdrawn as the nominee last week. President Trump announced via Twitter that he wanted somebody to be a bit tougher in that position, and that was something that Nielsen was not looped in on beforehand, and so she wanted to sort of go in there, meet with the president, talk about those concerns, but not ultimately resign. I mean, this was something that caught a lot of people off guard yesterday, including some White House officials and staffers at the Homeland Security Department.
So what tipped the scales against her? Your reporting suggests that perhaps Stephen Miller had something to do with it.
We're not completely sure whether or not Stephen Miller was pushing for Nielsen's ouster specifically. We do know that he has been talking to a number of different mid to high level officials across the administration. These are people who work at the Homeland Security Department, the Labor Department, State, and elsewhere inside, you know, some of the agencies within DHS like ICE and USCIS. And he's been talking to them about other individuals who he would like to ultimately push out of the administration. These are people who he doesn't feel are tough enough on border security or on implementing the president's immigration agenda. But we're not sure that Stephen Miller played a role in Nielsen's ouster, though we do know that he has been fairly critical of her, both publicly and privately, in past months.
So we do know that the president wanted somebody who would be tougher on this issue of immigration. And that's what I don't fully understand about this, because Nielsen was responsible for carrying out the administration's most controversial immigration policy, the one that was seen as the most hardline. And that, of course, is the family separation policy. I mean, how much more hardline does the president and perhaps his advisor want people to be?
Well, they want somebody ultimately who is going to carry themselves like Stephen Miller does. I mean, he is a loyal soldier in the president's efforts to essentially shut down the border, close it off to both unauthorized and legal immigration. And yes, Secretary Nielsen certainly stood and defended a number of contentious policies that this administration, this president, put forward, including family separation and other policies related to asylum and whatnot at the border. But she didn't do it, you know, happily. It was sort of begrudgingly supporting and defending these things in order to keep her job. And that was no secret to those closest to her. She felt as though she was one of the, you know, quote unquote adults in the room, which is what I've just heard from White House officials previously. And that in order to ensure that the president didn't go even further to the right with his immigration policies, that she needed to remain in place. And so that's why you did see her defending some of these controversial actions, despite, you know, simultaneously telling people behind the scenes that she didn't necessarily agree with the president's approach.
Now, as the Trump administration moves through people with operational experience at the border at the Department of Homeland Security, is there a concern that there is not very many people left on the bench to do the work?
There is definitely a concern about the personnel situation at the Homeland Security Department and who they can install permanently to lead that agency. A few of the names that have already been tossed around would have an extremely difficult time getting through the Senate confirmation process. These are people like Ken Cuccinelli and Kris Kobach, the hard right, you know, immigration activists who have definitely impressed the president, but at the same time would have an extremely difficult time answering some of the questions that they would face from Senate Democrats if they did get to the point where they were the nominee.
That's Gabby Orr, White House reporter for Politico. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Well, Israelis go to the polls tomorrow. What effect will Prime Minister Netanyahu's pledge to annex Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank have on voters? This is land Palestinians and peacemakers hope will be a future Palestinian state. And the promise from Netanyahu has been widely condemned around the world as one that may win him last-minute votes in his tight race for re-election, but will jeopardize a long-term peace agreement with Palestinians. Aaron David Miller is here, a Middle East Program Director at the Wilson Center and past advisor to Democratic and Republican administrations. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. But how is this settling in Israel? Who is Netanyahu wooing? Give us the context of, you know, what's on the ground politically in Israel right now.
I mean, I think the context is that Benjamin Netanyahu is in the fight for his political, his legal, and his politically existential life. Likud has ruled the 42 years since Menachem Begin laid claim to the party in 1977. 31 of those years has been dominated by Likud governments. Mm-hmm. Only twice has Likud lost to two former Israeli chiefs of staff, Ehud Barak on one hand and Yitzhak Rabin on the other. And now Netanyahu is facing in Benny Gantz a man who is the quintessential Israeli, deep military experience, decorated war hero, child of Holocaust survivors, grew up on an Israeli agricultural settlement. So Netanyahu now, I think, is prepared to do just about anything in order to win. He's appealing to small right-wing parties on the grounds that only he can protect the integrity and unity of the land of Israel, and promising to annex not just the settlement blocks, which I might add the previous two or even three administrations in Washington have basically agreed would somehow be attached to Israel through a peace negotiation with the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. He's also promising to annex Israeli settlements beyond the barrier, which are probably another 105,000 Israelis. So whether this is political expediency, a direction of things to come, is unclear.
Well, you mentioned Benny Gantz. He leads the centrist Blue and White Alliance. His coalition slightly ahead in the polls. As you said, this is just a squeaker for Netanyahu, who is facing corruption and bribery charges, not expected until the end of the year. But that cloud is hanging over him as well. But what is the thinking in Israel? What is the sympathy towards future negotiations for the two-state solution?
I mean, I think in theory, the idea of a separation from the Palestinians, in theory and on paper, still generates a credible degree of support, but simply not as much momentum and as much steam as it used to. I think most Israelis, the polls suggest, don't believe such a solution and settlement is possible. With the right leadership, Israeli and Palestinian, perhaps movement towards such an outcome is possible. But I think momentum has been replaced by inertia. And the reality is the Israelis control, since Oslo, 60% of the West Bank. Yeah. Now they control 60% of the West Bank.
Yeah.
And that reality, frankly, has not only proven to be manageable for most Israelis with respect to the security situation, but both economically and diplomatically, there have simply been very few consequences. Israel now has relations with over 160 countries in the world. This prime minister has personal relationships with Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump. So the notion that somehow the Israelis can't proceed with retention of these territories, otherwise they're going to become some sort of pariah, simply has not proven the case. The reality, Robin, is the future of a democratic Jewish state is on the table. That's the real danger. And I think that's a danger that somehow most Israelis have rationalized is out there somewhere, but it's simply not now.
And just in the minute we have, what do you mean by that? Because Israelis have seen themselves as, you know, a Jewish and democratic country. What are you saying about the second part of that?
Well, I'm suggesting that the occupation, and that's exactly what it is.
In the West Bank.
Not that the Palestinians aren't partly responsible for the dysfunction that exists in the absence of a credible peace process. But the reality is, if in fact you move to a situation which there's no separation from the Palestinians, the Israelis maintain control over 2.6 million Palestinians in the West Bank, de facto control in the sense that they control what comes in and out of Gaza. That's another 1.6 million, quarter of a million Palestinians in East Jerusalem.
We have to wrap up here, but you're
saying— Then the options are pretty bleak, Rob.
Yeah, that doesn't look like a democratic solution. Aaron David Miller of the Wilson Center, we'll be watching tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rob.
We're going to take some time now to look at two stories about indigenous people trying to reclaim their traditional relationship with wildlife. First, the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes of northeastern Montana. They're set to receive a lot of buffalo meat as Yellowstone National Park conducts its annual bison cull. It's meant to keep the park's bison population below 4,000. But leaders from the Fort Peck tribes say they would rather take in those animals while they're still alive. They spent more than $500,000 building a bison quarantine facility so that someday they can establish new herds on their reservation. But this year, Yellowstone gave them only 5 of the surplus bison, all of them bulls. Robert Magnin is director of the Fish and Game Department for the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes, and he joins us now from Poplar, Montana. Robert, hi.
Good afternoon.
Now, you say the National Park Service assured the Fort Peck tribes that they would be getting extra bison, more bison than you've gotten so far. What is your big picture vision for what you'd like to do?
What we really wanted to do is to be able to get all sexes of the buffalo on through a quarantine project here, and our ultimate goal is restoring buffalo onto Indian country all over the United States.
Now let's talk about why you have to quarantine them in the first place. There's a disease called brucellosis, and ranchers in your area, they're terrified of it. They say that Yellowstone bison carry this disease. It could affect their herds of cattle, wipe them out, and cost the ranchers a lot of money. Is it smart to be cautious here? Because you are getting a lot of pushback from these ranchers.
Yes, it's a lot of that is based on fear. We've been trying to educate the state of Montana for the last 7 years that when they make decisions, you base it on science, not politics. In reality, there's a very small opportunity where an animal can affect another animal with brucellosis. And that's during calving time when their females are letting go of their afterbirth. And the rest of the time, you can't get contact with another animal just that way.
And that's why you have a year-long quarantine process. That's what you built that facility for. So those animals go in, they stay sequestered for at least a year, so they go through that process, and you can then certify that they don't have that disease, at which point then what? You would release them out into the wild?
Yes, and upon graduation of the 1 year, then we could even turn them out to our existing herds or give them out to other tribes.
Yeah. Now, you don't need me to tell you that bison were once a very important part of your culture there. Nearly 30 million roamed the American West, but by the end of the 19th century, white settlers had all but eradicated them, and it was intentional. Politicians and generals thought that if they could wipe out the bison, they could put Native Americans into submission. How personal is this project for you?
It's very personal. You're right. The government always used terrorist tactics from the beginning, and they wipe out a nation's economy. That's how they brought Native Americans down to their knees. But fortunately, they didn't do a good enough job because Native American and buffalo are still here. And we're trying to build herds back to where they could be part of our economy once again.
And what would it be like on the reservation to have a free roaming herd of buffalo?
Okay, that's a misunderstanding, that phrase, free roaming. Even in Yellowstone National Park, they have an invisible barrier. But what we like to use here on our phrase is wide-ranging herds of buffalo.
Well, I take your point, but what would it mean to have that situation return to your land?
It would reconnect a lot of our native people to our culture. A lot of our culture is being lost because buffalo has always been the center of our culture, and we reconnect them through the buffalo.
How are the five bulls that you've got there in quarantine now? How are they doing? Are they happy?
Yes, actually, the 22nd of April, we'll do our first tests. And our existing herd is just outside the quarantine. They come by and they kind of visit the other bulls.
Yeah, they're a little lonely, I would guess.
Yeah. In time, by October, they'll be turned out with the herd. So they'll eventually get to be with our main herd.
That's Robert Magnin. He's director of the Fish and Game Department for the Fort Peck Assiniboine and Sioux Tribes. Robert, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, you have a good day.
Now to Washington State, where the Macaw tribe has the support of the federal government in its long quest to resume whale hunts off the coast. Last week, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced a proposal to allow the tribe to hunt a limited number of gray whales over a 10-year period. Environmentalists like DJ Schubert have been fighting that hunt for decades. He's a wildlife biologist for the Animal Welfare Institute. DJ, welcome.
Thank you.
And are you making the point that the tribe should not be allowed to resume this hunt?
Yeah, absolutely. We think there are, you know, legal, ethical, scientific, humane reasons why this hunt should not go forward. We think the National Marine Fisheries Service has erred in its preliminary determination of granting this waiver to the Macaw tribe, and we intend to continue to advocate for the whales and against this hunt going forward.
What's your environmental reasoning? The U.S. government says that up to 600 of these whales could be taken each year without harming the animal's population, and they were taken off the endangered species list all the way back in 1994.
Well, that's correct that they're not listed under the ESA anymore, Endangered Species Act anymore. In our mind, it's not a matter of can we hunt these whales, it's should we hunt these whales. And the reality is that there is a large population of eastern North Pacific gray whales, but then there are these two smaller populations of gray whales. One is the western North Pacific gray whales, where current population estimates are approximately 200 animals. These animals spend most of the year off the coast of Russia, but some of them do swim over and join their eastern cousins as they migrate from Alaska down to Mexico. There's also a group of whales called the Pacific Coast Feeding Aggregation, or Pacific Coast Feeding Group, which numbers currently around 243 animals. And both of these small populations could be hunted under the proposal issued by NIMS. Now, it may not be as likely that they would be killed as the whales from the larger population, but from our perspective, not a single whale should be killed.
However, the tribe might say there are ethical issues here from their perspective as well, because this was something that the federal government agreed to in a treaty with the tribe all the way back in 1855. And I'm sure you know that the history of the U.S. government reneging on treaties with Native people is a long and sensitive topic.
Yeah, it is. And we certainly feel for the various tribes that have been adversely affected by the government reneging on, you know, various treaty and specific treaty rights. In this case, however, the treaty language in regards to the Macaw indicates that they can whale in common with other citizens. The treaty was adopted at a time when gray whales weren't protected. In addition, we're not convinced that that particular treaty right remains in place because we think it's been abrogated by the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act in 1972. That very issue has been raised in two previous lawsuits about this hunt, but in both cases, the court never had the rule on the abrogation issue, so we think it's still a valid claim that needs to be adjudicated by the courts.
But we're also not talking about that many animals. Under this agreement, the tribe would be allowed to kill no more than three whales a year during even-numbered years and one whale for every odd-number year. It's not that many animals over the course of a decade.
That's true. I'm not going to argue against that because those are the numbers. But again, it's not can we kill the whales, it's should we kill the whales. And the reality is, in our opinion, particularly given the history of the gray whale and how commercial whaling drove that species to the brink of extinction, and the fact that the macaw don't need to kill the whales. They don't have a nutritional requirement. They don't have a subsistence need. Our question is, should we kill them? And we don't think we should. We think there are some animals that don't require to be subject to lethal control. And in this case, we don't think the macaw hunt is a wise future for these animals.
You say they don't have a subsistence need to kill the whales. But they used to, and the tribe is trying to make the point that that was a very important part of its lifestyle that is now gone. So, you know, you could say they don't need to do it, but if they want to, isn't that enough?
Well, the International Whaling Commission requires that an Aboriginal group demonstrate a nutritional need, a subsistence need, and a cultural need. They have to meet all three standards. Now, the macaw would argue that they have a cultural need because they claim that they've maintained their sort of cultural practices in regards to their history of whale hunting through their rituals and dances and so on and so forth. But the reality is that they have gone without whaling since like 1926, with the exception of one whale killed legally in 1999 and another whale killed illegally in 2007. So it's very hard to understand how they could possibly meet the standards of having a nutritional or subsistence need to whale.
Well, that period of time when they weren't hunting the whales since the 1920s was sort of mandated that they stop.
Not entirely. I mean, yes, they did stop because they claimed the number of gray whales was so diminished that it just wasn't effective for them to go out and hunt. But if you look at the historical record, including a lot of information that the macaw themselves have submitted to the government, they really stopped whaling in the mid-1800s. And by 1891, the macaw were so in demand by sealing vessels as navigators and as seal hunters that most of them gave up whaling because they could make more profit as sealers on the vessels that plied the waters off of the west coast of the U.S. and off the west coast of Canada, killing seals.
That's DJ Schubert, a wildlife biologist for the Animal Welfare Institute. DJ, thanks for your time. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Peter. Appreciate it.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
April is Financial Literacy Month. Put on your party hat, because according to a recent survey from the Business School at George Washington University, we need a lot of help because U.S. adults are scoring an F in personal financial literacy. The survey measured everything from knowledge of borrowing to comprehending risk, the section Americans, by the way, perform the worst on. So Jill Schlesinger is wondering, should more high schools teach financial literacy? She's, of course, our business analyst and analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, first of all, start with this survey and the questions that were asked that apparently we didn't get.
Yeah, I mean, look, some of these questions were probably pretty easy, but not every single one of them. I want to give you an example of one of the questions, because you may not find it totally easy either. So you ready, Robin? You ready for your big test?
No, I'm sure I won't. Go ahead.
Okay. Investment A will deliver a return of either 10% or 6%, with each outcome equally likely. Investment B will deliver a return of either 12% or 4%, with each outcome equally likely. You can expect to earn more by investing in which? Here are your options. Investment A, investment B. It does not matter. The expected return is the same with each. Don't know. No response. Hold on. Don't answer. I don't want you to embarrass yourself.
No, thank you. What's the answer?
The answer is it doesn't matter, because the question is not asking which could give you a better return. It's what's more likely. So it says a return of either 10 or 6 with each outcome equally likely. So you then say 10 plus 6 is 16, mm-hmm. right? Divided by 2. Mm. It's kind of like the average of that would be what's your most likely scenario is you meet somewhere in the middle. You meet somewhere in the middle of 4 and 12, you get to the exact same place.
Got it.
And this gets into understanding the concept of statistics, number one, and probability, number two, right? Mm. That's what's a very hard leap for Americans. It's also why comprehending risk scored the lowest of every single type of question on this test. So here's what it is. It's fascinating. It's not that we need some higher level math. We need math studies to include examples of personal finance. Mm. And that's really the key, that the study of math is not something esoteric. I'm such a math head, so I'm sorry that I'm going on. I'm very passionate about this. But we want the kids to understand the connection between being able to problem solve and make better decisions for themselves. And the way to do that is to use these kinds of real life examples in math class.
Yeah. What if you're an adult and you want to sharpen your financial literacy?
You know, I would say that there's a great answer to that. One thing that you can do is through the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, there is a wonderful part of the website called Money As You Grow. This came as a result after the financial crisis. And it was really intended to help you talk to your kid about money. But what's really neat about it is if you do that with your kids, or if you just do it in the privacy of your own home, it will talk about really interesting, rudimentary, and next-level concepts that you need to master. So I think that this is a really easy, free website, and it's consumerfinance.gov. Again, Money As You Grow.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
500 runners from more than 50 countries gathered in Denmark recently for the World Cross Country Championships. The setting was picturesque, but the athletes didn't have much time to send postcards home. That's because they had to conquer hills, mud, and water as they ran across the Danish countryside. Oh, and we should point out there were also Vikings. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock was in Denmark for the races and brought back this report.
Cross country is nothing like doing laps around a track. When you run cross-country, you're covering the landscape, jumping fences, crossing streams, cresting hills. And that was certainly the case in Denmark. Sebastian Coe was there. He's president of the International Association of Athletics Federations, the IAAF, the sport's governing body. He won 2 Olympic gold medals on the track, but says cross-country remains the essence of running.
And I love cross-country because I think it is quintessentially that element of our sport that sort of sums up the human condition. It's endurance, it's focus, it's strategy.
The roots of cross country stretch all the way back to England in the 1800s. It started as an imitation of fox hunting.
Run hard, run well, and may the devil take the hindmost.
That was the ceremonial start of these World Cross Country Championships, which were held outside Aarhus, a coastal city founded by Vikings 1,200 years ago. Jakob Larsen is director of the Danish Athletics Federation.
This has from day one been about turning people's heads. So whatever we could come up with that would make people turn their heads, yes, let's do this.
Larsen and his team designed a course the runners described as the most difficult they'd ever seen. Besides the mud and water, there were leg-busting hills, one up the grassy roof of the Mosgaard Museum, which hosted the event. American Stephanie Bruce runs marathons, but she said this 6-mile race was the hardest she'd ever done.
The cool part was, like, people thought it was very gimmicky. It was not. It was true cross country, but it beat everything up. Like, it beat your quads up, it beat your calves up, it beat your heart up, and it just, like, it chewed you out. It chewed you up and spit you out if you weren't ready.
The event was spectator-friendly, and 10,000 people showed up to watch. Part of the course ran through the beer tent. And yes, there were Vikings. Anna Sophia Bay was one of the Viking reenactors cheering on the runners.
It's really cool. It's a great event, and it seems like the people here are really happy and enjoying it, and the runners are really, really, really talented and good, and we enjoy being part of it.
And I see a kettle boiling. What's in there?
Coffee. We need our coffee.
African runners dominated this event, as they have in most years. But beyond the results, this was really about generating interest in a sport that has lost some of its luster. Mike Urquiola made the trip from Massachusetts to Denmark to help celebrate cross country.
I hope that people realize that if you put on a really good event, it will eliminate some of the mystique and the people think it's just a school age thing that people do, but it's not. It's a lifelong thing that people can do. I mean, if the Spartan races and the color races can make it, cross country is as tough or tougher than any of those things. And I think people would be wise to give it a try.
One hope from Denmark is that the Olympics will give cross country a try again. There's a campaign underway now to add it to the Olympic program in Paris in 2024. That would be 100 years after the last Olympic cross-country race. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
And leave it to Alex to plan a vacation around a running race. Well, there was no snow there in Denmark, but back here in the States, some late-season storms buried mountain states in the stuff, and some ski resorts extended their seasons. Good news for skiers and ski bums. Ski bumming is as much a term of endearment as it is an aspiration to live the mountain life. But decades of corporate mergers and tourism have turned scrappy ski towns into high-end resorts, making it harder for these low-wage workers to live that dream. Duri Berskaren visited the Crested Butte Ski Resort in Colorado and has this report.
In Crested Butte, Colorado, ski bums are still living the dream. Roll out of bed, pack up the car, and drive up a snow-covered road and into the backcountry. There are five people packed into a Chevy Silverado, which is a good thing because the car fishtails a bit on the high mountain roads. We come to a small clearing with a terrain park off to the side, a place for skiers and snowboarders to do their tricks.
This is the Lake Irwin Jib Park.
28-year-old Ben Hayden says locals built this park, scavenging old skateboard rails and pieces of wood. There's no ski lift, just a well-worn path for hiking up.
It snows and everything else will melt, but the way it's positioned, it'll hold snow and you can drive right up to it. So that's the perfect spot.
To support this lifestyle, the ski bums work construction as ski instructors, bartenders, in short, all of the jobs that make up the backbone of a mountain resort economy. But wages for these jobs are often low or unpredictable, or the work is seasonal. Still, ski bums find ways to make it work. Snowboarder Joe Steckdab moved out here from California 8 years ago when he was 18.
It's nothing glamorous, flipping cheeseburgers, but the first 4 years I was out here, I would camp all summer long.
But life here is getting more expensive these days. This year, corporate behemoth Vail Resorts announced it would purchase Crested Butte and two mountains on the East Coast in a $74 million deal. Locals say they hope Vail has the money to make improvements to ski lifts and a long-awaited trail expansion. At the same time, they worry that an influx of tourists will take all of the factors that make it hard to afford life here and shift them into overdrive.
It's a mountain town. We were significantly hit by the recession.
Frank Consella is a realtor for a firm called Signature Properties.
People were going to default on their second home before their first.
Since the country's economic recovery, he says, the price of a lower-end condo here has almost doubled. The Vail buy could make prices spike even more, but
we won't know for another 6, 12, 24 months. It'll be hard to say.
Not good news for ski bums like Josh Painter. When he's not snowboarding, he serves tamales and burritos at a cafe downtown. He says he'll leave Crested Butte if he has to.
Like, there's got to be some small, undiscovered ski town in, like, Montana or something.
To keep workers like Painter in town, some resorts are building employee housing and boosting the minimum wage. Vail just raised its minimum from $11 an hour to $12.25. Resorts are also sponsoring foreign workers on special visas, although that program has been cut back under the Trump administration. So the future of Crested Butte worries 31-year-old Katie Thomas. She says her parents were ski bums, and now so is she.
I was living in a city. I was dating a lawyer. I was looking at the prospect of marriage and children and a white picket fence, and I realized I didn't want that. I wanted to ski and work in the same day, and I wanted to be back in my mountains, so I came home.
During the day, she works behind the desk at a construction firm and works nights at a rum distillery that sells craft cocktails and steaming bowls of fancy ramen. She worries that Crested Butte will go the way of Aspen or Telluride, with the elite living in town, she says, and the workers commuting in an hour or more.
You know, one of the saddest things I do is I'll walk through town in April, and 90% of the houses are dark because they're second homeowners.
The glitzy transition may bring jobs, Thomas says, and also deep pangs of loss. For Here and Now, I'm Dori Buscarin.
And Dori's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. And this quick note, how about those Baylor women?
Denied by Turner, and that's it! The Baylor Lady Bears, 7 years later, are back at the top of college basketball with their third national championship.
Baylor's Lady Bears beat the Notre Dame Fighting Irish 82-81 in Tampa last night. Lots of drama along the way, including Baylor star Lauren Cox's horrifying injury. The Bears' second highest score, she went up for a rebound and came down in a pile on the floor with a buckled knee. Lauren Cox's fellow superstar Kalani Brown and the rest of the Bears looked like they might not recover. They gave up a double-digit lead, but they roared back in the final moments. So, congratulations, Baylor. And oh yeah, what else? Oh, men play. That's right, men play too. Tonight, the men's tournament comes to an end as Virginia takes on Texas Tech in Minneapolis.
Some new 2020 polling shows that in a few key states, former Vice President Joe Biden is still at the front of the pack among Democrats seeking to unseat President Trump. Biden still hasn't officially launched a campaign, and he's been dogged by questions about his unwanted touching of women over the years. But our next guest is interested in another question altogether. Derek Thompson wants to know who is running in second place. Derek is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from New York. Derek, welcome. Why second place? Why does that matter?
Right, yeah. Why obsess about second place, since this is obviously
you gotta win.
A campaign to win? I'm really interested in the psychology of decision-making, and this is one big decision-making experiment. So there's two reasons to care about second choices. Number one, first choices are really important to obsess over when consumers or voters aren't going to get any more information. But we're so early in the primary. The next 8 months are going to give us so much more information. And so it's important to look at, okay, when voters learn more, where might they adjust their preferences? Number two, second choices give us a clearer picture of what voters really want. If I tell you that my favorite candidate is Joe Biden, that could mean I like Biden specifically. It could mean I trust age and experience. It could mean I'm a moderate. But if I'm a voter who says my top choice is Biden, but after that I like Bernie, then Beto, then Mayor Pete, then Hickenlooper. Well, those are all guys. And maybe what I'm saying as a voter is I just don't want to vote for a woman. So it's really important to listen to what voters say they want, not only for their first choice at this level, but also their second and even third choice.
Okay. Also, another issue is that peaking too early for the candidates is always a concern. I'm thinking back to 2016. Remember this time of year, Jeb Bush was the Republican presumptive frontrunner at that point. It did not work out for him. What are some other examples you can think of where it actually is very important to make sure who's running, to take a look at who's running behind the person at the front of the pack?
Yeah, in the GOP primary before the 2016 election, the front runner was Jeb Bush. He didn't win a single primary. In the Republican primary before the 2008 election, the presumed front runner, if you can remember, was Rudy Giuliani. He didn't win a single primary.
Right.
For most of 2003, Howard Dean was the apparent front runner. I believe he only won Vermont. And then you look at Barack Obama, he was a famous second place runner behind Hillary Clinton for most of 2007. He was a two-term president. So in general, I think it's very important to look at not just who is the presumptive front runner this far out, but also who is eking behind them in second and third place.
And with this many candidates this year, I mean, it's got to be very difficult to do polling as well. So let's keep that in mind as we have this conversation. But there was also a recent Morning Consult poll that looked at people's first and second choices that I know you're interested in. What did you take away from it?
Well, the political media is so obsessed with lanes. We say there's a left lane and a moderate lane and a white guy lane and identity politics lane. It's just lanes and lanes. But when the polling firm Morning Consult asked voters who their second choice was, the answer was the same across the board. It was Biden or it was Bernie. Hmm. In fact, Biden voters said their second choice was Bernie, and the Bernie voters said their second choice was Biden. And this tells me, this early in the campaign, that the most important signal for voters isn't necessarily gender or race or policy or style. I think it's familiarity. These are the two most familiar candidates in the race. If you look at how the Morning Consult also asked people, do you have a favorable opinion or have you never heard of these people? The people, the two candidates who had most been heard of were Biden and Bernie. So in many ways, I think you early voters, this early in the primary, are essentially telling pollsters not who they're eventually going to settle on, but who they've heard of. And so it's dangerous to attach too much weight to those early predicted decisions.
But Derek, those two candidates are very different. There's Joe Biden, who tries to sell himself as a moderate, and there's Bernie Sanders, who, you know, doesn't at all. And yet you're right. saying that, that those two men could be the second choice for people. That's very interesting.
Yeah, and the reason why I think it's happening, and some people are going to say that doesn't make any sense. Like, why would a Bernie person like Joe Biden if the reason they like Bernie is that he's a leftist revolutionary? And why would someone who's a Biden fan want to vote for Bernie since Bernie's like a lifelong protest voter while Biden has been so historically in the mainstream of the Democratic Party? Well, the only answer, I think, is that you could say that a lot of voters just trust old white men. It's a possibility. I haven't looked that deeply into it. But another possibility, the thing that I think is more in keeping with the psychological principles that I'm most familiar with, is the power of familiarity. Voters really, really trust familiarity. And I think that it's really important to look at the fact that the two candidates who lead in the share of voters who have heard of them are also leading in the polls. That tells me that a lot of other candidates have a chance to catch up with them once they are exposed on the national stage.
And quickly, what about people who voters, a candidate who voters might be familiar with, say Elizabeth Warren, but aren't doing very well in the polls?
Briefly, I think it's just bad news for Elizabeth Warren. If you're that familiar with voters and you're still not polling well, that does not speak highly of your chances. That said, it's still very, very early.
It is very, very early, and that is probably why these candidates, they've already done 300-plus events across 24 states, according to the Associated Press, and that is only going to get higher. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.